got bigger and bigger and bigger. And those are the only words that I was given in the scene, just bigger.
And I am Lydia Malcolm, and welcome to Shocked and Applaud.
Happy New Year, guys.
Oh my goodness, it's 2019. Can you believe it?
That is the sound of someone relieved that they made it through 2018.
Without realizing that 2019 could be just as bad or worse.
Don't jinx it, man.
I know, it's only the first of the year. Lydia, bringing it down. So today, we're going to be talking about the 1984 adaptation of Michael End.
End, I think.
Yeah, the adaptation of his book, The Never Ending Story.
The movie is called The Never Ending Story, and it was directed by Wolfgang Petersen.
Oh, this just
such a great. I mean,
it's such a starchy open story.
It's entertaining. It's to the point.
We are bringing you the facts in this new year. We just want to bunch it up.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you wanted to eat a Twinkie in a very like efficient manner, you would grab that Twinkie and squish it real fast and shove it in your face hole. And that's what we're trying to do. We're bringing you a movie that you probably, if you're peers to us, have seen and have feelings about.
Right. If you were born in the 1980s, like early 1980s, you may have watched this when you were younger. Or if you were born in the late 1970s, this could very easily be something that you would have gone and seen in the theaters.
It certainly came out in the wave of the VHS revolution that was so much of my childhood.
Yes. But what is The Never Ending Story? Well, we hope to tell you today. Okay.
I hope we managed to tell you today.
I do not know why we're taking so long to get this podcast started.
We sat around while the setup was happening because Jonathan has the technical skill, and we like talked, we small talked ourselves out of being able to be like, so applauders.
Start from the start, and when you get to the end, stop.
Don't you quote Alice in Wonderland at me, Mr. McQuaid.
Okay, but what is the start? I mean, are we going back to the very beginning of, like, how movies were made, or the beginning of time? I mean, how far back?
Did Bastion create Fantasia, or did Fantasia create Bastion?
No, here's the thing. Let me rein you guys in, because I think you're going out there. It's not the never-starting story. It's the never-ending story.
So if it doesn't have an end, does it mean it never had a beginning?
No. Look, okay, my maiden name is Ray, okay? And a ray is a mathematical term that is a starting point, a point, and then a line that goes on forever. We are at the start. We are at the ray. We are at the point on the ray.
Okay.
Begins the never-ending story.
You make a good point, Ray.
Okay. So I don't know the age of most of our listeners. I would think that they have some familiarity with this movie. It seems like something in
the lexicon of what we grew up with.
Right. It's very 80s.
Oh, so. But without somebody showing up in high top sneakers and playing at an arcade.
Right.
It's 80s without somebody like eating a red piece of pizza with like way too much gel in their hair.
Do you, applauders, remember the theme song to The Never Ending Story?
Oh, I can't tell if I love or hate it. And
the theme song or the movie?
No, I have genuine affection for this movie with just a couple sticking points that I will discuss with you. But like the theme song, I am in dubious waters about. I don't know.
It's the song that doesn't end.
It's the song that doesn't end.
Yeah, it's the song that never ends.
Yeah.
I watched a lot of Sherry Lewis.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I watched Lamb Chops play along back in the day.
Thank you. That's what I was looking for.
I thought the horse puppet was mean, but Lamb Chop was good.
It could have used more rock biting puppets.
They look like big, strong puppets. Because she uses sock puppets in her hands, and he talks about the hands. It works. It works. Oh, by the way, applauders, we don't really have a connection between this movie and Die Hard.
I got it. I got the connection. It's Germany.
Oh, okay.
It is so much Germany. Okay, so here's the thing. So the connection between Die Hard and this movie is Germany. Now, The Neverending Story does not take place in Germany, but is certainly a German film in production. And of course, the antagonist in Die Hard was German, but also Bruce Willis was more German than the guys playing the Germans in Die Hard.
He was born in Germany.
Like, so much he was born in Germany, yes.
Many Grubers went into the making of this film, too.
Were there?
There were at least several Grubers in the credits of Netflix.
Did you see a lot of Grubers in there?
Yeah, there were some Grubers in there.
Applauders, if you end up watching this film, could you count how many Grubers there are?
Because we're probably... Gruber counter.
Gruber points. They're similar to Pedro points. They're more European than Spanish.
And they come with a bad American accent.
But if you collect enough Gruber points, you get a nice schnitzel.
Maybe some apple strudel.
Strudel.
Or maybe you can do a bad German accent.
Oh my god.
It is really bad, Naomi.
I know. Oh my god. I feel like, okay. Hey, applauders. Welcome to the show. We're going to...
Take two.
John's going to edit together four openings for you guys.
Okay. Maybe this is just me. It's really hard to like just start talking about this movie without just maybe we should just like jump into the movie and talk about how the movie starts.
Yeah, we've got a little bit of the backstory, both pretty little when it came out, so that there's probably no like I went to the movie theater and whatever. And okay, so the novel, we should say, was published in 1983, and then pretty quickly they filmed in 1983, and then the movie came out in 1984.
Right. And the author did not like the movie at all. There was an article by People magazine that said he did not like the film. And I think in the article they specifically stated that End was in kind of like he was like an advisor on the film. But then like 5 days before it showed, he got a completely different script. And he did not like certain aspects of the film because he didn't feel like, I think the biggest complaint was because Bastian isn't actually creating Fantasia in the same way that he is in the book. I've read half of the book. The first half of the book is very similar to the movie, but the second half of the book doesn't really, I mean, I haven't really finished it, so I guess I can't talk about that right now.
What I read said that the movie really ends halfway into the book. So if, I mean, you've already done all the work. Mm-hmm. Like now, I mean, if you read anything else, I don't even know if it would bleed into the sequels.
Right. I did read a synopsis of the way the rest of the book ends, and it sounds like the second movie kind of borrows elements from the second half of that book. Yeah. Okay, so this movie starts off with the very, very telling theme song. There are cloud formations throughout everything. It's
rolling clouds over techno-y sounding music.
Opening credits.
And there are a lot of credits. I didn't time it, but it had to have been a couple minutes of theme and clouds.
Just clouds everywhere.
They were supposed to be representative of something in front of the oncoming nothing.
Like if you've ever seen clouds come before a storm hits, it's very, very telling like that. And then we get a dramatic wake up.
Who doesn't love a snap awake?
Oh,
start
no,
to a movie?
No, it's
you've never
so
seen that
original.
Before.
Sorry. And okay. And this is our main character. His name is Bastian.
They establish him as a bookworm right away because he like sits up and he's like, oh, gotta check that book that's under my pillow.
Yeah. And I think there's like a bunch of books behind him, like in a shelf or something. And the next shot is him trying to open up a jar, which apparently fantasy nerds can't open jars.
I think this has to be part of his character that he can't open a bottle.
Yeah.
But like it also shows like his dad comes in and he like looks at him and he's like and he like marches over and opens it up for him. Like,
right.
Like, it very much is a scene that dad knows best.
Well, yeah, it has the dad knows best element. I mostly saw it as like, you know, have you ever seen the tropes where the dad is just kind of like frustrated that his son isn't like manly enough, even though he's like
I am that trope. Yeah. I don't know about you.
but manly enough or just like feminine?
Well, I mean, regardless of your gender, like a parent looks at their kid and has dreams about who and what they'll become. And when that turns out to inevitably not be true, then there's a bit of like some parents mourn it. Some parents adjust to it. And this guy's fighting it.
Yeah, yeah. And his dad then proceeds to make himself an orange juice, raw egg milkshake, protein shake.
I'm gonna call it a smoothie, but it just grosses me out so bad because it is strictly orange juice and egg. And you watch him drink it. It's frothy. And I know I got this thing against weirdly textured. If the kid's eating a piece of bread with butter on it, even though he opened a thing of jam, he's drinking orange juice with eggs in it. These people don't know how to eat food right.
Yeah, well, Mom probably took care of all of that.
Yeah, yeah. And we find out like later, like a few minutes into the scene, that Bastian's mother has died.
Yeah, dad kind of's like, we need to have a talk. I know your mom died, but you're scared of riding a horse and you're not joining this team and you're doing bad in math and blah. And I'm like, what the hell is this conversation?
Well, I mean, it depends on like how long it's been since Bastian. If you have ever lost a parent, it's not something that ever like leaves you. It's always something that kind of sticks with you. And you find that, I mean, even if you have to pick yourself up and move on with your life, it's not something that you're ever really going to let go of. That being said, the dad is not very interested in actually being an emotional support system for his son. Yeah. Also, I mean, the conversation ends with Bastian just sort of being like, okay, dad, kind of in a way that I relate to, in that sort of like, I just want this conversation to end. So I'm just going to agree so we can get that done with. And his dad's just like, oh, well, this was a good talk.
Don't be late for school. My favorite part of this conversation is when he's like, your teacher was saying that you're drawing horses in your math book. And he's like, it was unicorns. It was unicorns. And he's like, what? And he's, never mind. Like, you got to be aloof about your magical creatures.
Unicorns. They're unicorns. What? Nothing.
Look, if you're going to be disobedient,
it's like trying to explain to them what a podcast is.
Dad, no. You just don't understand. I'm going to be over here with my iPad.
Dad, it's like a radio show that you can have any time in your pocket. We're going to have to get Jonathan a microphone.
So, yeah, it's just very much like, Dad, don't understand. But I do like that Bastian changed. He was more interested in fantasy over his math work.
I wrote down, your mother died. Why aren't you being an overachiever?
Mm. That was the first thing that was kind of ambiguous about this movie that I saw. We are not told exactly how long it's been. And so if let's say that it's been like 3 months. Not, I mean, Bastian seems like he would go ahead and be doing exactly what, you know, you would be doing at 3 months. There's a high possibility that even if it's like a year since it, Bastian had a better relationship with his mom than his dad.
Look, lady test aside. Nope, that doesn't sound right. That sounds more sexist. Hold on. Like a representation of females aside, this film, for only having one female character and one mentioned female character, is all about this woman in a lot of ways, I feel. And I'm sure we'll get into it when we get into more dramatic themes. But the other thing other than unicorns
versus math.
Unicorns versus math. And why aren't you an overachiever even though your mom is dead? Is this kid, he starts answering his dad in this kind of monotone way that sounds exactly like the kid in The Shining. And I thought, I heard that tone and I was like, because I love that kid, Danny Torrance.
So Bastian is walking through the cities and he gets stopped by bullies who are like, give us your lunch money, kid. And he's just like, no. And they chase him down an alley where they stuff him into like the cleanest garbage can.
Give us your money, mama's boy.
I noted that they put him into the garbage can and then they run away. But they're pretty diligent because they're standing out of the alley making sure that if he comes out again, they can chase him again.
Yeah, they waited for him.
Mm-hmm.
Crazy. Although I have a ridiculous story about chasing somebody and waiting for them around a corner that we can put on the Patreon later if you want to. But it's pretty embarrassing, and I don't want anybody who's not giving me money to know the story.
Okay, so speaking of Patreon, is that like one of the levels? Like if they do like $10 a month, we give raw audio? Or do you want that to be a little bit higher?
Oh, I'm not sure. All of our details are listed on our Patreon page, and you're welcome to go look at it. But everything else gets discussed in production notes because I don't want to make promises to you that I can't keep.
Right.
But I will tell you all of my embarrassing stories if you pay me.
And so they chase him into a bookstore.
Dun, dun, dun. Lucas really likes this part because he's like, didn't you just see them run into the store?
That was kind of like, I mean, he gets in there and he kind of like drops his bag and just stands there and they just move. And that was kind of what made me think maybe there's some ambiguity because he could have like turned a corner and then gone into the bookstore.
Yeah, we don't see that exterior shot.
Yeah, yeah. But Bastion's like, hey, it's a bookstore. I'm going to just go ahead and see what's this cool place. It sounds like a place I'd want to hang out. And then a gravelly old voice is like, get out.
Yep. Now that I know his name is Mr. Coriander, now that I've looked at stuff. But before that, you know how I label people. It's the I don't like kids guy.
Yeah. And he does not like kids. He chastises Bastion for knowing nothing about books. And Bastion's like, I have 186 books at home. And this guy replies with, bah. Comic books. And I'm like, whoa, dude.
Yeah, slow your roll, man. Some of us got our learning, our reading chops on comics. Mm-hmm.
Like if you put 10,000 Leagues Under the Sea and like a Spider-Man comic in front of like an 11-year-old boy, guess which one they're going to be picking up? It's going to be the Spider-Man. And they're not necessarily going to just be looking at the words in there. They're also going to be picking up the images in all of those different panels. And a good comic book always like puts some extra stuff in there. So yeah. Anyway, so don't knock the comic books. Also, not all comic books are for children. Just read the Sandman series by Neil Gaiman.
Mm-hmm.
So this guy's just millennial bashing.
He's like, you and your Twitter.
He's like, have you ever lost yourself in the book? Right. And he gets real close to the kid. And like, here's the thing. I got proximity issues. So if we're having a conversation, if you're being very intimate or very adamant at me, you are like, if you're less than 6 inches from me, you better have good reason, be succinct, and then get out of there. Right. Otherwise, I'd like 2 or 3 feet. Like, cause I'm American, and that's not me being racist. That's just societally what we've agreed to have as a safe space between people having a conversation.
18 inches of personal space. That's just like a rule of thumb around here.
Yeah. So the I call that the creepy too close face talk. And it really went on too long. Like I wanted him to inspire him to read. Like I don't know if you ever watched that cartoon movie. His friends are animated books and the librarian turns into a wizard who turns him into a cartoon. And he's like, I'm a cartoon. And the guy's like, no, you're not a cartoon. You're an illustration.
Macaulay Culkin, who is...
Yeah, that sounds right.
Wishmaster?
No, Wishmaster might have been a horror movie.
Yeah, that sounds right. That sounds like a horror movie.
Okay. Page Master.
Oh, I knew there was a master in it.
We were so close.
Did that have Whoopi Goldberg in it?
It did. She goes, get your hands off me. Hanging, you're messing up my pantyhose. Now I got to straighten out my Little Mermaid underwear.
Yay.
I knew it this whole time. All right, after some savvy editing tricks, we'll go back to the guy being like, you're reading those safe books, you wuss.
Yeah. And he's just like, but that's what I like about him. I can stop, you know, being in a dangerous position.
I feel like he was more like, yes, I become those people, because that's what he was getting, the guy,
right.
Coriander was getting at. He was like, do you ever become the people in the books? And he's like, yeah, but then I can put it down. And he's like, that's too safe.
You aren't schizo enough, kid.
Right? Like, you're driving a car, but you wear a seatbelt.
Driving a
car and you're going the speed limit. You're not driving on the sidewalks. Yeah. So he's like, pretty much trying to get Bastion to leave. And maybe that's what he, I mean, it's really hard to figure out what this guy's ultimate goal is.
He gets this twinkle in his eye when he finds out that he's an actual reader. He's trying to engage him in this thing. This book is too dangerous for you. And then Machina, the phone rings, and he's like, not this book. And he sets it down and puts it under a newspaper for protection.
He makes it very easy for Bastion to go ahead and take a look.
Yeah, he's like, don't even look at it because I'm putting this piece of paper on it. You couldn't easily move off it. And then he goes to the other room to take the call. And then he knew because when Bastion does take the book, he's hanging up the phone. He turns around, kid is gone. He's like, he doesn't look like my book is gone. He's like, oh yeah, my book is gone.
The way that he looks, he's happy that Bastion's gone, but then he looks down and I don't know if we actually see his expression when he recognizes that the book isn't there.
No, he looks down and he sees the note that Bastion's written and he's like, oh, he took the book, but he's not a bad kid because he left a note.
Okay.
You always are less of a jerk if you leave a note. I mean, think of a situation where you have to Audi 100 pretty quick, where leaving a note doesn't leave the person who's unawares of what you're doing in a better place. Bastion's note says, I will return your book. Not stealing. I'll return your book.
Right. And he's running through the schools and he's got the book underneath his coat.
Surprise, surprise. He's late to school.
Big surprise.
Because it's like saying don't be late to school is like the gun in the first act. Because the next act, that trigger's going to be pulled and you are late.
Right. He goes to his classroom door. He steps up and he sees that they're taking a quiz. He says it's a math quiz.
Math test. Oh, no.
Like maybe it was a scheduled math test. Maybe.
Well, his dad mentioned that he had a math teacher. So they might have had separate class sections. So he might have known that he was going to his math class. But when he observed that all the kids were silently working on a sheet.
Yeah, he knows it's a test. Yeah. And so he books it for the attic, which has a very convenient key left out in a broken little box that says
break. Yeah, it's a lock box for the attic key, mm-hmm. or it's a busted old something or other. Yeah. But it says attic on it and it's got a key in it and there's like free access to it.
Right.
It doesn't seem very safety conscious.
Like, what goes through the mind of someone? Because, I mean, back in the 80s, you didn't have to necessarily like go to the front desk to be like, hey, by the way, I need to stop in here. Like, I mean, weren't like a lot of doors. I don't know.
I'm with you. A lot of physical doors were open and a lot of emotional doors were closed. Well, here's the thing. He goes straight there. You kind of get the feeling that he knows where his hideout is going to be.
Right. So he goes up into the attic and he pulls some dusty bedding into the light.
Yeah, it looks like a PE mat.
Yeah, and it's all dusty. There's some mats underneath it. I would have grabbed for one of those, but that's just me.
Yeah.
And he opens the book at the front, by the way, and he becomes...
Thank you, Bastion.
And he becomes the narrator for the book that he's reading, which is the bulk of the movie. And we are now getting into the movie. The bulk of the movie book.
No, you're right. You're okay. Right. The bulk of the story happens within this book.
Right.
And it is narration time. Let us go to what I have dubbed Labyrinth, Snail and Creatures, End of the World Campfire.
We see this kind of dramatic like approach of something towards this camp.
Like there's this deep rumbling and everybody kind of like, I don't know if they were resting or they were whatever, but everybody like perks up from whatever they're doing. And they just, you can tell something's coming, but it's.
You don't know what. Right. At which it turns out the thing that's coming is a giant rock creature on a giant rock bicycle or tricycle or motorcycle.
I thought it looked like a bike.
Yeah. And there's this exposition about how there's this terrible nothing that's taking over all of their home, which is called Fantasia.
The rock biter. Oh, we should probably say who's in this scene. There's the guy rolling up on his like 5-story bike, the rock biter, the labyrinth looking snail. David Bowie's the labyrinth looking snail and fellow creatures, and the end of the world campfire. So let's go through and see who's in the scene first. I'm not in any particular order. We've got some characters whose name I know and some characters whose actor that I know and some people that I don't know, but I know what they are. And that's all I will describe them as.
OK, 1 second. I'm pulling out the book.
I should let you know, plotters, that Lydia has a copy of the book that she's halfway through approximately right now.
Yes.
How can you be halfway through something that is never ending?
This is the problem with giving your producer a microphone.
So in the book, there's like a fourth character. It's a Will-O-the-Wisp. Aww. And his name is Blub.
Oh my gosh, that's so cute. I could die.
Now, this is in the book. The tiny guy who's played by Deep Roy.
I love you, Deep Roy. You might recall him from Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory.
Or not, if depending on how you feel about the movie. And his name is Gluck-Cuck.
Gluck-Cuck. He's adorable, small, wearing a suit and top hat. And he's dubbed, so you don't actually get to hear Deep Roy's voice.
Right. And then we have the Night Hob, whose name is Vush-Vazool.
Which is that the guy in the ground?
Yeah, the guy with the bat.
Yeah, he's weird. I think of him as a little goblin creature. What is he? Yeah,
they call him a Night Hob. And they don't really go into too much detail. I think they do describe the way he looks. And he looks a little bit like disarming in the book from the way that they describe him. I could probably find it.
Well, he rides a bat, who's also in the scene. And
right, he kind of like beats up on the bat more than like in the book. He's just like he talks very small, and he's not very like condescending at all. He's just very, you know, kind of adorable.
There's this racing snail that we're going to talk about in a second who steals the show. So eventually, what's his name?
Vush-Vazool.
This is why I call people like Gremlin Guy and like, okay, whatever. Vush-Vazool.
Even the actor's name is Tilo Pookner.
Tilo is fine. Tilo's like, everybody cares about a snail, but nobody cares about my stupid bat.
Well, you're calling it a stupid bat, so maybe you need to start like caring about
the
him.
The bat seems perfectly sweet and accommodating, so mm-hmm. maybe the perception is on you.
Right, right. And then there is the rock biter, which in the book is called a rock chewer, and his name...
I called him a rock eater all yesterday. Yeah.
So, rock muncher. That's always another title. Okay, never mind. I'm not going to try.
The word muncher kind of grosses me out, I guess.
I am not going to try and pronounce his name because it is long and I will butcher it.
The Rock Muncher's name?
Yeah.
No, it's better as Rock Muncher. Yeah. He's played by the same guy who... He's played by Alan Oppenheimer, who also plays a certain dragon we like. He also plays a certain bad guy, who's like the only physical bad guy that we see. Mm-hmm. And he's also the surprise narrator, mm-hmm. who doesn't make any bloody sense at the end. But I'll probably rant about that in an hour or 3 days when we're done with this.
Right. I will also be ranting about that.
Okay, so we see those first four creatures, bat, snail, mini guy and ground guy.
Yeah.
And then they all start perking up because they hear this deep rumbling in the distance. That's when Rock Biter.
Yeah.
Rolls up on his rock bike. Because here's the thing, you know that there's this big thing coming and you think this is it, but it's actually just the dude rolling up on his bike.
Right.
And then we have okay, my notes are so sad. They're like, explaining to kids the existential void of death.
So after the rock biter shows up, he goes into how there aren't any rocks where he's at. And there's a reason for it, because there's nothing.
This movie goes into wordplay so often that it's really hard to describe to like a fourth audience, which is you guys.
Right, right. So he says that there is this thing that is taking over.
The rock creatures is like, there was a lake,
a beautiful lake where I was, and then it wasn't.
And they're like, they dried up? And he's like,
no, it just wasn't. And like,
there was nothing there. And then it got bigger and bigger.
So we know that this thing, the nothing, is now trying to eat Fantasia.
And I will go ahead and be pulling notes out from the book, because there's a couple of things about the nothing in the book that make it easier to understand by the way that the book does it. In the book, the nothing is said to be this sort of like... So it's not something that you can describe any physicality to, but there is this sort of like pull that when people see it, they're kind of drawn towards it.
That call of the void thing that called our monkey ancestors to jump. I know they were apes to jump out of trees and stuff.
But the other thing that the nothing does is it eats away at people like moths eat away at clothes. So like when the book describes someone being taken over by the nothing, there can very easily just be, you know, the person walking around, but they got a hole in their chest.
Ooh, that's creepy.
And they don't feel any pain. There's just nothing there.
That's how I felt through a lot of my early college life.
I honestly thought you were going to say that's how you felt through a lot of this movie.
No, I'm sorry. I had lots of feels through this entire movie. But okay, so Rockbiter's like,
so I'm going to go to the ivory tower.
And they're like, we should go to that's where we're going. All this stuff is happening at our place too, which makes the wordplay about him describing this missing lake irritating. But they're like, why are we waiting? We should totally go. So then the whole racing snail thing comes in, this beautiful giant snail and this tiny Deep Roy.
Would you like me to carry you? I don't want us to get behind by you on a snail. And he's like, no, it's okay. It's a racing snail. Well, I don't think that even a racing snail.
Oh, dude jumps on his bat. And then this guy's like, I think I'm going to eat more rocks before I go.
Yeah.
And that's where I wrote, gluttony will kill you.
And it almost does, because the nothing comes up a rolling and then he rolls out of there.
And so the setup tension is gone because they're out of there.
Right. But they do go ahead and come to the ivory tower. And there's a lot of like sweeping flying shots throughout this movie.
Yes.
We see the guy with his bat flying through the air.
Yeah. They cut to him looking around so that you're looking at things he's looking at. But here's my thing about the flying around shots. It's often just clouds and mountains and ground.
Mm-hmm.
And there's one shot at the end that I appreciate, but really for the most part, I'm like, could this be done in like 5 seconds? Because we're about to spend 2 minutes doing this.
Right. I think there's like a total collection of like 5 minutes of just straight flying shots in this movie, which, I mean, it's already a short movie. Tells me maybe that could have been filled with some character development.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like, you could have filled it with me seeing the land teeming with people that I will care about if they get smushed or
obliterated.
I want to say oblivion because that's like nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Oblivionated. So let's go to the crowd at the tower.
Yeah,
I'm gonna leave the description of the tower to Lucas. Please look for the descriptor at the end because that's gonna be pretty. Oh, guys, there's a little marshmallow in this bowl of cereal at the end. Lucas is gonna give us a little insight into his viewing of this movie. So okay, so Bat gets there first, obviously, because he's gonna get to the top of the tower the quickest. You see him peeking through the windows, all super creepy. Like, I don't know why, again, people aren't screaming at the top of their lungs. But this scene I have entitled, hey, do you want to try a new kind of prosthetic or costume? Just come to the set. We'll just have them all. We'll just do them all. You want to be a bird guy? Be a bird guy. You want to be a multi-face person? Okay. You just want to be one giant face person? Yeah, face a bow it up.
Do you want to be a mushroom person?
Oh, that was so cute. He looked like a Goomba.
Yeah. And this is just to kind of represent that what the three people in the last scene were pretty much talking about, how this nothing is taking over. And
they all have to go see the Empress to see what to do because she's the most powerful thing in the land.
And now you see just how widespread it is because there's like more people who are gathering up at the top.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then this guy steps out. Does he have a name? Well, this very distinguished gentleman steps out and
Chiron, C-A-I-R-O-N. Yes.
Chiron steps out, looking all sorts of regal, tall, dark-skinned man with a weird ridge on his head like a fish and like this long flowing beard. True to the book, as far as if I recall right.
Yeah, in the book, he was a dark-skinned centaur. But
oh, yeah, he wasn't a centaur in the movie, which is a bit of a letdown. Yeah. But I didn't know it at the time, so I just thought he was a good-looking man with authority.
But I thought that was pretty cool that he was written in as being dark skin, and they kept that in the movie. I thought that was awesome.
This movie ain't whitewashed, even though it's the only brown person.
And
I mean, I'm not sure he's native, so I guess two brown people. Oh no, wait, there's Deep Roy. This thing is freaking progressive. Nice. Okay.
For 1984, yeah, it is.
Thank you.
So he comes out and he says that the Empress is sick and she can't help you, and we believe that her sickness is connected to the nothing.
No further explanation needed.
And he then announces that a warrior from the people who hunt the purple buffalo is going to be coming by and he will stop the nothing. And his name is Atreyu.
There are a couple strands of native peoples throughout the entire thing. When Bastion wakes up, he's got a Native American in a headdress, like a picture of him behind him on the wall. When they introduce this character, you know that he already knows what a buffalo is, which we would call a bison. But, you know, we're particular.
Yeah. And in the book, Atreyu isn't actually Native American, though that is very much what, like, he's actually like a green skinned.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Okay. So looking up IMDb page, they tried to make the dude green.
Yeah.
But he said he ended up looking like Fungi.
Yeah, it wasn't until Guardians of the Galaxy came along did we get, like, you know, covering people in different colors. But I like the fact that I don't know if the actor is actually Native American. He kind of looks like he is.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I didn't look up his ethnicity. Nope.
Yeah.
Sorry, but he's got a beautiful caramel tone, and he most certainly passes as Native.
His name
is Noah Hathaway.
And he's very pretty. Noah Hathaway is a pretty young man who every time when I was a kid, I saw him, I was like, is that a girl? And then the movie would establish that it's a boy. And I would, if I watched it again, completely forget. And I'd be like, oh, she's really pretty.
I remember watching this when I was like, you know, 10, 11 and having a little bit of a crush.
There's no wrong reason for that. Okay, so dude says there's this warrior coming. Kid steps forward. I mean, he's just, there's a small break and he's just there. And they're like, you're supposed to be a warrior. Bring me the other Atreyu.
He's like, I'm the only Atreyu, dude. And he's like, bah. He gets dissed, pretty much gets dissed for being a kid, and Atreyu gets salty.
So he has to, because it's a prophecy or because the emperor said so or whatever device brings us to this young person. He's given the Orin.
Right. But he's given a choice. He says, you alone must take this. But well, no. In the book. Sorry, I'm getting the book mixed up with the movie. In the book, because the Empress, she never gives commands. She always lets people choose. And I thought that was pretty cool. And that's why everybody like respects her. It's not just because she's like super powerful. It's because she lets people choose what they want to do. And they respect her for that. But in the movie, they're just like, our world is dying and you alone must go ahead and take the symbol of the Empress.
Yeah, it's like a double Ouroboros. It's got two snakes eating each other's tails in this intricate knot. Not terribly intricate, but definitely like a Celtic knot sort of shape. Mm-hmm. And the dude says, this speaks for the Empress. Whoever holds this speaks for the Empress, and it will guide you. It manages to do that like twice.
Mm-hmm.
I have some information on Noah Hathaway. His maternal grandfather, Leon Ringler, was a Jewish immigrant from, I'm going to butcher this name. It's Poland. It's Poland. And
his last name is Poland, and that's hard, or it's Polish, so it's hard to say.
There's a city in there. It's like Przemysl, which is it's in Poland. Noah's maternal grandmother, Lily Genka, was born in Uruguay, also to a Jewish family originally from Eastern Europe.
Okay.
So he got his fame in Battlestar Galactica and some TV spots before that. His character's name was Harry Potter Jr. in the movie Troll, which was in 1986.
Harry Potter Jr.
Jonathan, can you join the podcast? Can we make this the official? Jonathan, do you want to join the podcast and do all the work?
Well, I mean, I don't want you to feel like you got to do all the work, but I do like having someone who does a little bit of research. We're going to have to get one of those dual booths, like on Frasier, where Frasier is sitting in the booth and his producer, Roz.
Local throwback. Also, he was considered for the role of David McCall in the movie Fear. Do you remember that one?
It was. I remember the name, but it's all right. Well, nicely done.
So we just found out that Noah Hathaway is not actually Native American.
That's cool. Be European, man. You totally pass. I mean, I got no cred to say that you do, but Atreyu has Orin, and now he's sent out. And okay, so everybody, when he shows up at the tower, everybody's like, who are you, right? And doesn't know anything. As he's leaving on this journey where he's going to wander for a week, as he's leaving, though, everybody's like, bye, Atreyu! Bye! And everybody knows his name. Everybody knows who he is. Right. And I'm like, all right. No, not all right. You guys don't know who he is.
The guy with the bat was hanging out when Atreyu shows up. He gets that information over to him because there was that whole thing. I want to hear about Atreyu the man, not Atreyu the child. So maybe he got it. That. So Atreyu goes riding with his noble steed Artax through the sweeping landscapes of Fantasia, and he was told to go alone, and yet he takes his horse. But something bad happens to the horse, so maybe.
No, we're not going to talk about that.
Sorry.
We're not
going to
talk about
skipping ahead.
No, it's not that I don't mind you skipping ahead. We've foreshadowed some, but I don't want to talk about the horse thing until I have to, and then I want to leave it right there until I have to talk about it
again.
Okay.
So Yeah, I did want to bring up, there was this moment in the book where Atreyu is actually going through the forest that those three people that we meet were in, and he comes across some trolls. They take him to see an area where the nothing is coming in, and there's like parts of the trolls that are missing. And again, they don't feel any pain. There's just nothing there. And they take him to a spot and he climbs a tree so he can get a better vantage point. And when he sees the nothing, it like shakes him to his core. He understands what they're fighting against. He goes down the tree where the trolls were and they're not there anymore.
Oh, creepy.
Because it got sucked up by the nothing.
It was super creepy.
Yeah. But it's not like suction. It's more like, you know, I always read that part and I think, I wonder if they just vanished or did they like walk in? Because there are some.
Called into the void.
Yeah, they were. There was this like draw.
We're cutting to the green-eyed death wolf.
Yeah, so we get this this wolf who Bastion narrates is an agent of the nothing called the Gamork, and he goes on his own quest for Atreyu. And
we do through the movie get moments where we are his eyes, a la the Evil Dead, like the evilness running through the forest. Like you are Gamork, and you're like. Mm-hmm. So I think it's. A nice perspective change, but it's hard to establish so many characters, plot lines, and have depth of character in such a short film. So
right.
Oftentimes what I contest is that, you know, I don't know much about this wolf. We're going to meet him like two or three more times. I like the little visual of where he's at and what he's doing, knowing that he's like the creeping or skittering evil. But oh my gosh, there's no way for me to care about this character. Mm-hmm.
I will say he kind of reminds me of like the anti-Aslan. Like he's representative of a power that's kind of not his own, but he's also this animal form of that entity.
Yeah. When we get to his final speech, there's a lot to be questioned with how he is, who he works for, and what his exact intentions are. Because, he's directly questioned, and he gives as direct an answer as he can, but it's still not satisfying.
Right. And again, like this is one of those things that if there was like a TV show or a book, you could go into more detail. And there is a chapter that is pretty much devoted to that speech that is between him and Atreyu later on. And it goes more in depth and it's
Lydia. Are you going to make me read a book?
You don't have to read the book.
I feel like you're going to make me read this book.
I am not. Okay. Okay. What can I do to make you not feel that?
Nothing. I feel nothing.
Yeah.
It really doesn't matter. Like if I end up reading the book, I will be better for it. If I choose not to read the book, I'm no lessened by it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just giving Lydia a hard time because this is a comedy podcast.
Wait. We're supposed to be making jokes?
Make jokes. No.
This is just going to go tits up.
It's better if we pretend it's not a comedy podcast. Like this is a serious podcast where we happen to say the word a lot. And then the jokes just kind of come.
I was taking this very seriously.
I feel so serious right now.
Super serious.
I'm so serious. So we see the Gamork. Blah, 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 blah. Now we get to Atreyu waking up in a little cove by a little stream. And we have what I call, because of the events of the future, stupid establishing affection with the horse shot.
Not even stormy clouds could keep us from coming back to the airwaves this year for an exciting and adventurous new season of Plotter. Thank you for joining us in part one of our review of Wolfgang Peterson's children's 1984 classic, The Neverending Story. Hey, this is your audio engineer and narrator of the nonsensical, Jonathan. Reminding you that this ad-free, woman-owned conversational comedy survives on the grain of one small but fantastic wish. Your applause! Join us in 2019 as a $5 per month Patreon applauder as we venture into more murky waters and oracles of originality. Wanting a bit extra this month? We've recorded Naomi's review of this fantastic children's film with her nephew Lucas, and the longer version will only be available to our Patreon members later this month. We'd like to thank you for your continued interest, mentioning, and sharing of our peculiar podcast. Want me to say some names? Sean Hall and Jean Dahl have been our biggest sharers on Facebook, and Christine Nicholson continues to provide us with encouraging comments along with her $5 Patreon membership. You can download other episodes on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Podbean, or directly from shockedandapplaud.com, along with additional content and updates. Ready for part two? We'll be back in only 1 week as Atreyu ventures further through the challenging realms of Fantasia. From Shocked and Applaud, thank you for patroning the peculiar.